No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. This week, we've had to pre-record because our special guest is not able to be with us live, so you won't be able to call in. But this is a really interesting show, and we'll give you information where you can Skype questions at a later date, and we'll be happy to get back to you. Maria, welcome.
Thank you
for being with us once
again.
Thank
you. As always, thank you. It's a privilege and an honor. And again, if it weren't for our listeners, we wouldn't have a format or a reason for broadcasting weekly. So it's an honor on all ends.
Well, thanks. And today we have with us Will Carlos. Will has worked as a foreign correspondent in Asia and South America. He worked for Reveal News Service, and prior to that, he was a senior correspondent at Public Radio's International Global Post team based in Rio de Janeiro. Before that, Will spent 8 years at The Voice of San Diego in your neighborhood, Maria,
yes.
Where he worked as an investigative reporter and was head of investigations. During his tenure in San Diego, he was awarded several prizes, including a National Award for Investigative Reporters and Editors. He has been a finalist for the Livingston Awards for Young Journalists twice in the last 5 years. He surfs, spends time with his family, travels to silly places, and pretends he's writing a novel. Welcome, Will.
Thanks for having me on.
And my first question to you, as a guy that travels to silly places and pretends he's writing a novel, why don't I know you? Because you sound like the guys I've been hanging out with for 40 years.
Well, you never know. We might have been on the same plane or in the same watering hole or establishment somewhere. You never know. Yeah.
And thanks so much for being on the show, because I know that you had to arrange and juggle a lot of things to be here. Let's talk about your latest report. For those of you who may not know, Reveal News is part of the Center for Investigative Reporting, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan group which takes on very many important issues that don't seem to be necessarily in the mainstream media. As you know, our show attempts to do the same thing, to deal with things that you don't hear about every day on CNN, although Will has actually been on CNN with this particular report, I believe. But he recently did a report which shows, called Protect and Slur, which shows that 400 officers, they found 400 sworn officers, is this correct, Will, on social media that were part of racist internet
online hate groups.
Now explain to us what you did, Will. Don't let me do that. You tell us.
Sure. So I think it's important to say from the get-go that, you know, what we found was a sample. You know, it obviously wasn't exhaustive. There are hundreds of thousands of police officers in the United States, and we couldn't look at every single one of them. So what we did, Senator, was we started off with a premise that we know that there's a problem in American policing. We know that there is racial bias and that there are, you know, that there are all these shootings, there are problems. There have been so many studies showing that there are problems with bias in policing. And we figured out a way to at least sort of show one angle of it, which is to show that these hundreds of officers are members of closed Facebook groups. So these are extremist closed Facebook groups. So you're right that many of them are racist. Some of them are misogynist groups, anti-woman groups. Some of them are anti-immigrant groups or anti-Muslim groups. And then there are also anti-government militia groups like the Three Percenters and the Oath Keepers, which are some very troubling groups. So what we did was, you know, essentially just sort of show this this problem that a lot of people acknowledge exists, but to show that it is online and that these sworn officers who are charged without protection hold, you know, in some cases pretty deep biases against members of the community.
May I ask, Will, if they're closed Facebook groups, how did you get access?
So for a while, it doesn't allow people to do this anymore, but for a while, Facebook would allow researchers and journalists to plug into what's called its API, which I believe is its, I'm not a technical guy, our data team figured this out, but basically we could go to Facebook and say, we want to know everybody who's a member of this group, and we give them a group's name, and we would then, through our, we had to write a software for this, but through that software, we would then get the names of all of the people who are members of those groups. Now, it didn't tell us whether or not they were police officers, but we did get the names of people in groups. And I want to just explain, if I may, how we then figured out of these people who were police officers. So we started off with about 1,200 extremist groups. We go to Facebook and we said we want the names of everybody who's in these 1,200 extremist groups. That gave us about 1 million names.
Wow.
Now, obviously, only a few of those are police officers, right? Only a small proportion of those. So what we then did was we went to Facebook and we asked for the membership roles of about 200 police groups that we identified on Facebook, things like Friends of the NYPD and things like that. We then got about 1 million names on that group. We then put all of those names into a database and asked it, who is a member of both a police group and an extremist group, because that led us towards police officers, and that gave us 14,000 names. So we knew that at least 14,000 people were members of at least one extremist group and at least one police-related group. And we then had to just manually sift through and look at as many of those profiles as we possibly could to try and figure out if they were police officers, whether they said that they were police officers on their profile. Often it was by identifying photos of them in uniform or photos that people had tagged them in where they were wearing uniforms. And from that, of those 14,000 people that we identified, we looked at about 2,000 of them, and that's where we found our hundreds of police officers. We could have looked at a lot more, but frankly, I was starting to go a little bit crazy after spending months looking at Facebook pages, and we had to just kind of draw the line. We found around 400, and we just said, that's enough to show that this is a problem. Let's publish our stories.
So from when to when did you capture the groups and the police officer groups? Like, what's the time frame?
So it was basically done within about 48 hours. On one day, I think it was last April, we go to Facebook, we say, you know, on this day, we want this data, and then it takes, you know, a few hours to download the data. But it was a quick process. It's all automated. And this was a snapshot in time, you know. So
right.
Some of the people who were members of those groups then now aren't. Some of those groups have been taken down or disappeared. So it was a snapshot in time, but Facebook no longer allows journalists to do this. Funnily enough, right after the Cambridge Analytica scandal, where it was, you know, shown that they were sharing all of this data with political activists and stuff, political operatives, that they shut down the ability to do this, and you can no longer get this data.
And one final question, Michael. Yeah. So April 2018?
Yes, correct.
Okay.
I think it was April, yeah.
Okay.
Well, and do you think, I mean, what's happened recently in Philadelphia, for those of you who may not know, 13 police officers were fired. I find this so disturbing. 13 were fired over racist tweets on Facebook. More than 50 were reprimanded for similar activities. And they found that more than 300 officers just in Philadelphia were found to be involved in some way with racist tweets or on racist websites. So, Will, should we be doing a more exhaustive study of this? Should there be, should the federal government, should the Justice Department take on a study like you did, do you think, and do this nationwide?
So I've been working on a story that I'm going to publish next week about solutions, about what needs to be done. And I'm looking at it from various different angles. But I don't think it's necessarily the federal government's place to be doing this. I think police departments independently and individually need to be doing a lot more training and B, a lot more vetting of police officers. I mean, I'll give you an example. There was one guy we found in Portland, Oregon, who we found was a member, an active member of a group connected to the Oath Keepers, which is a sometimes violent anti-government group that doesn't believe in the sanctity or the basically doesn't believe that the federal government should have any power. It believes this should just be the Constitution and then the local sheriff and anyone in between is illegitimate. So this is a police officer who is a member of that group, who was posting on that group, was also posting extremely, I would say, disturbing stuff, railing against other religions and Christianity in really quite sort of nasty, violent terms. Now, we identified him. We sent the police department, the Portland Police Bureau, all of the information that we had. And their response was, well, he did this before he joined our department, so we don't think that we can do anything about it. And so that what that screams out to me is that departments need to be taking a close look at people's social media. If I can find this stuff on people's social media, then police departments and detectives certainly can. And it seems that it would behoove police departments to do that, and then to train their staff properly on what they can and cannot say when they're on social media representing, you know, because you're always representing the department when you are a police officer.
Well, you know, the follow-up that I have to that is that in the case of Philadelphia, the police commissioner was an African-American. But yesterday in the Washington Post, they reran an article from the Baltimore Sun, which showed that they've done a study, the Justice Department has done a study through a federal monitoring program that they have, and they found out that the police have a really hard time following up, especially on civilian complaints. They're really not doing a very good job when there's instances of police brutality and other charges brought by the public. They're not doing a very good job investigating them and resolving them, according to the Justice Department. So that's my question. If you have a racist that's head of your local police department, can we really count on you to weed out the racists?
I don't think you can, but I mean, I'm a big believer in democracy, and I'm a big believer in the American system of devolution and of local power. And I think that, you know, ultimately, if you do find out that your local police chief is a racist, I would hope that the community would act to get him out of office, him or her out of office, you know. So, and we've seen that happen. I mean, we've seen police chiefs have had to step down after things have been, you know, uncovered about the way that they behaved in private or their past. And I do think that that should be down to the local community. I don't think it should be, I frankly don't. And these are my personal views. I don't personally think that it's the federal government's purview really to be policing local police departments. Now, let me just modify that a little bit. I mean, what I'm talking about is on a granular level of hiring and training police officers. I do think that there should be greater oversight of police departments, and I say this as someone who's covered, you know, the police as part of my beat reporting in San Diego and elsewhere. I do think that there should be greater oversight when it comes to things like officer-involved shootings and disciplinary complaints against police officers. I think the way that those complaints are often investigated in most parts of the country, and especially in San Diego, is that they're usually investigated by the local DA, which is a huge conflict of interest. I don't want to get too far away from the subject of my stories, but that's been a bugbear of mine for a long time, that you can have, you know, a police officer who's involved in a very questionable shooting, and in certainly in my home state in California, is, you know, usually politically right in bed with the local sheriff or the local police department, and whose staff have to work every day with police departments. So I do think there's a place for federal oversight of police departments. I just don't know that it should be in policing, pardon the pun, people's social media accounts and hiring practices. I think that should be down to the local chief or sheriff.
You know, what would be nice, though, is that for there to be a consensus about what the training should look like and include, i.e. diversity and inclusion and et cetera, and removing stereotypes, that then could be rolled out nationally, but not federally mandated. But the police officers themselves, if they could agree to a 6-week course or a, you know, 12-week course or something that's consistent, then at least we'd have something that was across the board, regardless if you were in a small city or an urban area or suburban or, you know, large metropolis, what have you.
Right.
They would share a common language, if you will.
I definitely agree with you there. And I think that's particularly important when we look at the development of extremism and racism in 2019. And I cover extremism and racism and hate for a living. And so I myself find it hard to keep up with the latest terminology, with the latest imagery, with the latest things that people are calling themselves, or the latest dog whistles that they're using, the latest ways that they're communicating, the platforms they're communicating on. It's a full-time job keeping control of that. So I do think it would be useful for there to be a federal sort of guidance along the lines of which you're talking, that would help departments not only train but also keep up to speed with how that movement is kind of thinking and communicating.
Yeah, and we've seen this over the years too, where the federal government has had to move in, actually, and even replace police department investigations. For example, the three civil rights workers in Mississippi who were, the police department was actually complicit in their murders, and the FBI had to go in and investigate. So in terms of civil rights, very often the federal government has to get involved. But I understand exactly what you're saying, and you should know, I've got to tell this personal story real quick, that I was beat up by the police when I was a hippie protester. I had long hair. Of course, I'm a white guy, so it wasn't racially motivated. But I was beat up and thrown in jail overnight. And when we went to the DA to prosecute the police officers that beat me up for no particular reason, there was a hearing, and the DA said to us, look, I got to work with these guys. He really did say this. I got to work with these guys every day. And my sister was my lawyer. And he said to her, I was a minor. And he said, your brother got slapped around a little by the police, and we're sorry for that, but I'm not going to prosecute a police officer for this. Tell your brother not to hang out not to exercise his First Amendment rights if he doesn't want to get slapped around. Now, this was over 4 years ago.
I'm sure it happens every day across America.
Yeah.
I'm sure it happens to people of color every single day, and it happens to marginalized communities every single day. And that speaks to that inherent sort of ridiculous situation of local VAs investigating local police officers. It doesn't make any sense, and it desperately needs to be changed. And one other sort of meta point, sort of big picture point that I, as you can hear from my accent, I'm a British guy. I moved to the States in around 2001. And what's always confused and surprised me, and especially during this project really confused and surprised me, was just how many different police departments there are, especially in rural areas. I mean, you look at some small towns in places like Missouri, and every town has its own, you know, 5-6 person police department, and it seems absolutely absurd that that's how, you know, I mean, I'm all for local policing, but you know, the time seems to be ripe, if we're going to talk about, you know, training people properly and having resources, for these small departments to be conglomerated, you know, to be joined together, because it seems absolutely crazy to me as an outsider that you can drive, you know, 2 miles and be, you know, go from one police department to another, drive another 2 miles and be in another department's jurisdiction with all the costs of running a police department. It seems absolutely crazy. And it's no wonder that training isn't being done and they're not hiring perhaps the best people sometimes.
Well, and that's, I think, speaks more to having a national curriculum, because frankly, those smaller units probably don't have the resources and or maybe the acumen to create something that's really going to make a difference. Whereas if we could roll out something that national with those resources that we have as a country and then give it to whatever organization there is, I think that would behoove all of us.
And sadly, it's not only that they don't have the resources or the acumen, but they often don't. And I wish, you know, it's a cliche, but I came across this time and time again in my reporting, which is when I was dealing with a small town and a small police department or a small sheriff's department, and I talked to the police chief or the sheriff, they, you know, would often tell me, you know, we don't care. We don't want your opinion. You know, go away. We're not interested in talking to you. Whereas, you know, the big departments would at least make a show of either investigating or responding to our concerns. You know, I came across sort of small fiefdoms across the United States again and again and again, where I was like, you know, shouted at or the phone was slammed down on me and I was told to go away because I was an interfering journalist. So if that's happening to me as not even a member of the community, imagine how that's happening to, you know, to minorities and people who are working and living in those communities and have to deal with these people every day.
Yeah, the good old boy network. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And these little departments have different priorities, too. I had a cousin who, for example, was part of the Toms River Police Department, notorious police department. They were sued by a woman's group because over BFOQs, bona fide occupational qualifications, because they required all their police officers to be at least 6'5" tall, because they only had a half a dozen police officers, and they wanted them to be intimidating. And actually, they were ultimately undone because they took a back in the 1970s, took a congressman's son and locked him in the trunk of a car and drove him around Toms River and showed him off at bars. I mean, it was just a hideous.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, just a hideous incident. But that was their priority. Their priority was to be big and bad, and you know, because they were small. So yeah, Maria, I think you really hit the nail on the head. Well, let me ask you as a journalist, Will, because I assume that, you know, the First Amendment is a sacred principle to you. What about the First Amendment in this case? Do these people not have a right to express their opinion on Facebook and elsewhere?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me that. They don't, actually. They don't have the right to express themselves exactly how they want to. When you take a public office, when you become a public police officer or you know, a public servant of some kind, you give up your you know, blanket First Amendment rights. Now, you don't as an individual. You can still say whatever you want to, but and the Supreme Court has ruled on this. A public body, a public agency may you know, find against you for that and may ultimately suspend you or fire you from your position. And there's a very good reason for that, especially when it comes to policing. Police departments have long had the concept of conduct unbecoming of a police officer, which is a term I'm sure most people are familiar with. And that could be anything from, you know, going out and getting rowdy and drunk in a bar to posting, you know, racist memes on Facebook. And you must, every department, even the smallest departments, has a code of conduct that it requires police officers to sign, and an unwritten code of conduct where people are expected to, you know, represent their department in the best light and represent themselves in the best light. So am absolutely in favor of the First Amendment. I think it's, you know, especially as somebody who's an immigrant from another country, it's one of the great American ideals that I hold very sacred. But the fact is that when you are being paid by a government office and often a private, you know, private entity, you, by representing that that company, that department, that agency, do give up your absolute right to freedom of speech.
Well, in do we end up in the long run then pushing these sentiments underground? You know, as a politician, look, we're very careful. Politicians are very careful, if they're good politicians, about every word that comes out of their mouths. Now, Maria will tell you that I often find myself in Dutch because I speak I speak from my heart instead of being politically correct. But is that a problem? Are we just going to push these guys underground? They're going to continue to be, you know, I guess my question to you is, how do we determine who is racist? How do we weed them out in up front so that we don't get racist police officers?
That's a very good, insightful question, and it actually speaks to a broader issue that we're dealing with and covering in the world of hate and extremism in America, and that is the deplatforming of racists, of hateful people. And if anyone's not familiar with that term, that basically means, you know, barring people from social media sites primarily, and also from web hosting and things like that. And there's a big discussion, obviously, as I'm sure you're well aware, in Washington at the moment about what the role of technology companies is. Yes. And how you ensure, is it freedom of speech for a company to ban somebody, or is it violating that person's freedom of speech to not allow them on a social media site, for example, that's ubiquitous and that everybody uses? And my personal response to this is, look, I mean, it's my job to go and look at these spaces and see this horrible stuff. And it's not very fun and it's not very pleasant, but at least it's there for me to see, you know, and you're right. If you take these people offline, if you hide them in cages and hide them in, you know, in sort of metaphorical cages online that I can't access and people like me and other watchdogs can't access, they're still going to say and think the same thing. They're just going to do it, you know, in secret where nobody can see them doing it. So, and I think honestly, I think most people who cover this world will also tell you that the most dangerous people in America right now, the people that keep me up at night, are young, usually white, usually male adolescents who have been completely turned into monsters online, who've been radicalized online. Either they hate women, or they hate black people, or they hate Jews, and they they're going out and committing acts of violence. We see this every few weeks in the States, another killing by a young man who's been radicalized online. And I bring that up because those people, that stuff isn't often happening in public. It's often happening on closed websites and behind closed doors and behind secrecy online. But it is happening. And in some ways, it's better to be able to see and glimpse that happening. I'm glad that, you know, racist police officers have been fired in Philadelphia. I'm glad that some of the officers that I pointed out are being suspended or fired. I think that's ultimately good. And it's a catch-22, because once you report on this stuff, then you'd like to think police officers will clean up their act and be more careful about what they say and do online. But, you know, the quid pro quo of that is that you can't see them doing it and you can't call them out for it. So it's a tricky one.
But the repercussions now are getting to the point where a normal, reasonable person would most likely change their behavior if they value their career and what it does for their self-esteem and their families and everything else. And I have two questions for you, Will. One is the demographics of that which you pulled off of Facebook, male, female, age, race.
I'd say almost probably 80% middle-aged white males, I would say.
So that's, you know, almost, consistent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the guys you see in police cars are the same guys that you see, you know, in these hateful groups. It mirrored the demographics of your average police department.
And then my second question to you is, and this comes from a field that I'm also involved in, which is psychology. And just less than 2 weeks ago, there was an article published by the American Psychological Association about racist police officer stereotype. And they studied 784 patrol officers. 80% were male. Nearly all were patrol officers, with just over half being white. And on average, the officers were in their early 40s. So that's consistent with your data. And I'm curious if you've seen this study, because it was just published on July 15th. But it's under the auspices of the American Psychological Association. And the lead researcher says, who's a psychologist, officers who were highly concerned about appearing racist reported lower confidence in their moral authority, and that led them to reporting more support for using coercive policing while on the job.
I haven't read the study. It doesn't surprise me. I mean, I've spent a lot of time among police officers, and I'll stress that there are some absolutely fantastic people, you know, keeping America safe and keeping communities safe, and I'm certainly very glad and very grateful that they're doing it. But I will also say that, you know, I'm a white male, and my blood pressure goes up whenever I'm near a police officer in the United States. I've read too many reports where police officers have been able to get away with things with impunity. And I don't think the problem is necessarily, I mean, obviously the problem is, you know, racism is a huge problem. But I don't think you're ever going to stop racists and people with, you know, with troubling views from becoming police officers. I think the sort of people who want to become police officers are often people with, you know, with a desire for power and a desire for control, and some of those people are going to have questionable views. I think what needs to change is when it comes to accountability. As I was talking about earlier with, you know, how police officers are investigated, I think there needs to be a huge reform across the United States when it comes to accountability of police officers, because you're never going to stop racists from becoming cops. There's always going to be some of them. What you need to happen is you need for when there are questionable things that happen, when there's data showing that somebody is, you know, arresting people of color indiscriminately and out of proportion, those people need to be held accountable. They need to be investigated. Those investigations need to be public. And I think that it's high time that happened in this day. It's a real, real problem.
Well, we see it in Washington. We see this movement that you're talking about right here, Will, in Washington. You know, now all our police wear body cameras. There are civilian review boards. The community has been very proactive in trying to hold police accountable. I don't know if they're doing a better job, to be honest with you, because a lot of these procedures are new, like the body cameras. We've had a couple of questionable incidences, for example, where body cameras just were coincidentally shut off. But isn't that convenient? At least you're trying. I would just like to say there are a lot of good cops out there that I know as well. You know, this isn't, we're not here to persecute police officers. We're here to get, as you are, to get to the truth and remove the bad ones. And also, just to finish my story about perception, when I was in college, I went back to the very same police department that beat me up, to the exactly the same precinct, and went on a ride-along program, cut my hair. By that time, I cut my hair, put on a suit and tie, and went on a ride-along program. And I can tell you, they treated me very much differently than they did when I showed up with my long hair and my Frank Zappa t-shirt, and they beat me up. So perception is really, really important.
Go ahead. This probably doesn't need to be said, but I mean, of course, you have the option to cut your hair, right? I mean,
right.
My African Americans don't have the option of making themselves less stopping themselves from being profiled by racist police officers. They don't have that option, so you do, I do, we can dress nicely and everything else. And it's not going to, we can change our perceptions to police officers who hold extreme views. A lot of people a lot of members of our community can't.
Yes,
interestingly enough, when the two of you are mentioning that, you're reminding me, I live in a fairly upscale suburban area, and I had a friend who was of color, and he was a very successful Hollywood writer, producer. I mean, like, he wrote Taxi and et cetera, and he would not be driving. He called it driving while black, which was something that was very much, he said, I can't be on the road after midnight. I'm just a target. And I was like, you're kidding. In this day and age? And he goes, nope, it's a real thing. I just don't want to put myself in harm's way.
Well, there's another famous case, too, of a guy named Montel Williams, who was a talk show host, who was a Navy Academy, went to the Naval Academy. He was a Navy Academy graduate in Annapolis. And he said when he was in Annapolis, they told him, as an African-American, don't drive through Prince George's County. Find some, that's a large suburban county right outside the District of Columbia. They said, find another way. Don't drive through Prince George's County, because it was so well known, 35 years ago, that the police department was racist and you didn't want to be black and stopped in that county, which is horrible, but everybody knew it. Everybody knew it.
And there are counties like that in the States right now, and that people of color cannot, are advised not to go through. I talked to an African American lady as part of another story that I did, and she was describing how her daughter goes to a prestigious college, but it's sort of in quite a rural area, and between the college and this lady's home in Georgia were some counties which are known for having racist police. And she told me a story about how her daughter was driving home for Thanksgiving and her car broke down. And this woman, as she heard this, as she got the call from her daughter, she said, what county are you in? She heard and her blood ran cold, and she immediately ran to her car and raced out there to pick up her daughter. And that, it's absolutely disgraceful that situation is still happening in 2019, and something needs to be done about it. So I you mentioned body cameras. I'm a member of a profession that a lot of people don't trust and think are dishonest and all the rest of it. I would happily wear a body camera 24 hours a day if people wanted me to, and I don't even get paid by the public, So I think that people who are paid by the public, who are paid by our tax dollars, should be, open and willing to the idea of being closely monitored, and we should be able to see what they're doing and how they comport themselves, and we should analyze those videos, and then we should take action upon them and get people out of there who don't fit the bill. Because, and I think that every good cop in America should support that too.
Well, I since you brought up the issue of trust, I'd like to ask you, as someone who grew up in England, how much of a role you think that plays? Because I've got to tell you, the first time I went to London, I was a teenager, and I couldn't believe that they had cops that didn't carry guns. I was just amazed. I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, which was, just a horrible place.
Swashbuckling.
And to see cops without guns. And part of me believes that must be that the British have great respect for the law, right? I mean, is that true? Do we have less respect?
I think it's the other way around, almost. It's so, it used to be a very popular kind of hijinks thing that public school boys and university students would do. One of the sort of classic things to do would be to steal a policeman's helmet, one of those round helmets. Then you display it proudly on your mantelpiece. And now, can you imagine somebody stealing a police officer's hat in the United States? I mean, they'd get shot, they'd get killed, So I've been present. I've been present leaving sort of, you know, pubs in England in college days where there's been a police officer and they've been ridiculed and mimicked by, you know, drunken people leaving the bar and they don't do anything. Now, can you imagine that happening in the States? I mean, that just wouldn't happen. So I actually think that in the UK, there's very much a perception that people who work for the government work for you. Police officers work for you. They are your employees. And they're not, as such, they are, you know, answerable to you. And they are, in some ways, kind of deferential, you know, towards you because you're their bosses. And I feel like in America, you know, police officers are, you know, they're just largely above the law. You know, I mean, they're largely above the law and they're largely given free rein to, you know, to do whatever they want to. And you know, as I say, I spent a few weeks once reading every single officer involved shooting report from the city of San Diego, from the San Diego Police Department for the last 10 years. And some of the stories were absolutely unbelievable. You know, I mean, people who were shot in the back as they were driving away from a police officer, you know, teenagers who were shot in the back, through the back of the car, through the back window, as they were driving away, you know, and nothing happened to the police officer. So I think that I go back to my main point, which is that there's way there just isn't enough accountability. And you don't see that in the UK. I don't think you see that in many countries in Europe. You don't, police officers aren't, A, they're not put up on a pedestal, and B, they're not, they don't have this sort of self, you know, this kind of aura of untouchableness, if that's a word.
Well, and or macho.
Yeah,
in
absolutely.
Other words, you know, it's my way or the highway. Because right. I would argue yeah. that probably, and I hope this doesn't sound too grossly overreaching, that female police officers probably don't have as much of that swagger and ego that their male counterparts do.
That's certainly been my experience. But there's one other point I want to make, and that is that, you know, I mean, look, cops in America have a really awful and difficult and dangerous job, and they certainly True. Have a much more awful and dangerous job compared to police officers in the UK. Not to put down British police officers, but the reason American cops carry guns is because, you know, a lot of Americans carry guns too, right? And a lot of bad guys carry guns. And so they have to protect themselves. And so, and the reason that UK police don't carry guns is because guns are almost unheard of in most parts of England. You know, I remember as a kid, you know, you would never hear about shooting ever. If someone was shot in the UK, if it was an officer involved shooting or just a sort of a run-in between rival gangs and somebody was shot, it would be front page news. It would be huge news. So, you know, we don't have the gun culture. It's not as dangerous. And I'm sure that contributed to, you know, to cops swagger in the US because they have to be very tough and they have to be very, you know, very guarded and all the rest of it.
Well, you know, just on that note, since last Wednesday, we've had 9 people murdered in the District of Columbia.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Murders are up 40%.
Oh,
it's really crazy. And to your comment, Maria, once again, I think you've hit the nail on the head. When I was in sociology in college, I wrote a paper on the fact that I thought women should be police officers more than men because they were less prone to violence, to which I got a C because the professor said it was a ridiculous premise. But you know, right? We're men. That's what they say classically, right, Maria? Because your field of psychology, that men are either fight or flight, right?
Mm-hmm,
that they,
right.
You know, they're less likely to negotiate. They're less likely. You know, although I must tell you, we have a Montgomery County police officer. Montgomery County is the richest county in Maryland, well-educated. Every police officer has to have a college degree, very well-educated. But we have a woman who's now on suspension for using the N-word when she approached a bunch of kids at a McDonald's to question them. So racism, I guess, is you know, there's no sexual distinction necessarily with racism.
One of, except, one of,
Well, I was going to say this study that I'm referring to, it did show that women were more supportive about working with the public. And then they say that that could indicate that recruitment, training, and counseling that address imminent violence associated with toxic masculinity could improve the quality of policing with the presence of women.
There's no doubt. I will say that one of the worst police officers I found was somebody who, I don't know her real name, but she was somebody who was posting under a pseudonym on Facebook. There was one photo of her. She was a member of all sorts of different really troubling groups, and she would post openly racist and just awful stuff, like right there. People knew who she was. But I didn't, because I only had her pseudonym, and she was at the NYPD. It's still at the NYPD today. So it's, you know, this isn't only men. There are certainly, I came across a fair few women with extremist views too in my reporting.
Well, and you know, just as far as training goes, another example from my life is that we have a group of police officers in Washington, the Capitol Police, and the Capitol Police guard the Capitol and the area around the Capitol. They're very well trained. They have a group that just arrests protesters. That's all they do, because there's so many protests on Capitol Hill. And I can tell you that when you're arrested, I've been arrested for sitting in front of the blocking traffic in front of the United States Senate. They're like the most polite. They're the nicest people that you ever want to meet, but they surround you with eight cops who are all over 6 feet tall, very, very imposing, and then they're very polite to you. Like, look, we want to, you know, but they make it very clear to you that you shouldn't try anything, because, you know, they're so overpowering in their presence. And this is true wherever you go in the Capitol. When you walk into the Capitol, there's not a cop that screens you. There are three cops that stand there and screen you. So, you know, they really, and I think that must be part of their training, that they're out there and, you know, they have a really, really dominating presence, but then that allows them to be very flexible and very polite, because they're certainly, you know, they deal with the public constantly, right? The public constantly goes into the Capitol. So training's a good, can do a lot of things, I think.
Well, especially if you screen properly.
Yeah. Yes.
Right.
So what do we do to screen? Is there a way we can screen? Can we set up a test to tell if you're racist?
That's probably more Maria's field than mine. I don't know. I mean, I imagine that there are such things. I think what Maria was talking about earlier in terms of having a sort of a national curriculum when it comes to both training and offering guidance to these police officers. I think what my stories have shown, and what also the excellent reporting by the Innocence Project, which you mentioned, and just to digress for a second, it's not the Innocence Project, it's the Transparency Project, I think they're called. I'm probably mangling their name, and I apologize. But they're the people who uncovered all that racist conduct by Philadelphia police officers and got those cops fired. What they took a different approach to looking at Facebook. What they did was just get the Facebook profiles for several different departments and then just go and look at people's Facebook pages. What my reporting did was to look at what people were saying in closed groups when they thought nobody was watching. And Maria, you asked me earlier how I got that information. I actually joined a number of those groups using my real name and answering questions completely honestly. I joined the groups and then did searches inside them for the police officers' names to see whether they were active and involved, and in some cases found police officers posting troubling content. But I think the net result of all of those stories, of my work, of that work, of the great work that ProPublica did looking at the extremely troubling and racist CBP group with all the immigration officers in it, I think the net result of that is that, you know, it's clear that there are people working for these departments who hold these views. It's clear that the militias that I mentioned earlier, the Oath Keepers, the Three Percenters, have their claws very deep into American policing, and I think that should be a concern to everybody. And I think that there needs to be some sort of a national effort to at least offer guidance and training to particularly small departments, but also to take a look at the bigger issue of why are these people with these extremist views, A, why do they want to become police officers, and B, why are they being allowed to get jobs as police officers, and what is it about the cultures of these departments that manifest these ideas in people's heads and keeps them growing? Because it's obviously a big problem.
Well, we're running out of that may be a great place.
And
to
that's
end,
like
actually,
a chicken
well.
Or the egg thing, because it's you could make the same comparison. Why are pedophiles drawn to priesthood?
Well,
not that all priests are pedophiles, right?
Right.
But those that have attacked the young and vulnerable were pedophiles.
It's funny you should say that, because I spent 2 years of my life making a documentary film about pedophile priests and finding them in South America, which you and your listeners can watch. It's called Fugitive Fathers. If you type that into Google, you might find it interesting. Yeah. Quick plug there.
Boy, that should be in your bio too, Will.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about Maria. She has almost a clairvoyant sense. It's a little scary sometimes. Will, tell us, since you've been such a gracious guest and you've come on despite the fact that you have a very full schedule, tell us, is there anything that you want to say that we haven't asked you? And please tell us how people, what your website is, how people can find out more about this.
Sure. So people can just go to Reveal News, REVEALnews.org. And on there, they have to scan down a little bit, but they will see the series of four stories called To Protect and Slur. You can also just type To Protect and Slur into Google, and that should come up right away. I will say that obviously I can go into a lot more detail in several thousand words in print than I can, in interviews. So if anyone questions, what I've said or thinks that it wants to know more about how we came to these conclusions, read those stories first. If you have other questions, shoot me an email. I'm very responsive. I'd love to hear from people who've read my work and have questions. And you can email me at wcarless@revealnews.org. And that's Carless as in without a car, wcarless@revealnews.org. I'd love to hear from you.
Well, Will Carless, thank you so much for being on our show. I wish you safe travels wherever you're off to, and I hope you'll come back at some point in the future and tell us about other projects that you're working on. Thank God we have journalists out there that are doing the kind of work that you do. So thank you very much.
And I know it's got to be, Will, there must be a psychological toll that you certainly suffer from because of your ethics and your integrity and your character, and then you're reading about people who don't have those attributes. That has to be depressing.
Yeah, I'm very lucky that I have a very, very supportive family, and I'm able to do this job without, I don't think, it impacting me too much. I'm quite able. Well, yeah, you said in my bio, I like to surf, and I think that's my therapy that keeps that keeps me in my place. So I think that's
all right. Well,
that's helped me. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, and you now have a friend in Washington, Will, so if you come, please look us up. I can't take you surfing, but I'm from New Jersey. I can take you bowling.
All right. Okay,
thanks so much. And we're going to leave you with our song for the day. This goes out to Will for all his hard work. A one-hit wonder from Bobby Fuller 4, I Fought the Law. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Yes, thank you.
Give the people their right to vote. give the people their right to vote.